Hello and welcome to the Just Interesting podcast, the podcast that's not boring, it's not too interesting, it's just interesting enough. And once again, we have our very special guest with us today. It's Richard Jones. Richard, how are you?
Not bad at all.
Good stuff, good stuff.
Enjoying the winter.
Yes, I know, winter. I think winter's probably my favourite season. I know, controversial.
Winter has come.
I love the winter, yeah. And Richard, last week you came on and you spoke about Jack the Ripper. This week's a little bit different, isn't it? It's our Christmas special, to be frank. And we're talking about Dickens, Charles Dickens, and, well, his influence on Christmas, specifically as the Christmas special, but also a little bit about, you know, about you and what you do in terms of your London guides to Dickens as well.
Yes, yeah. Charles John Hotham Dickens, whose London is everywhere. No matter where you go in London, you'll always find something that Dickens knew, visited, and wrote about. So the whole city is Dickens City, as opposed to Jack the Ripper, which more or less is confined to the East End of London.
Ah, fascinating. Well, I'm so looking forward to this, because I don't know about you guys, Robin and Alex, but I know less than I should do about Charles Dickens.
And likewise.
And I hear that Robin has actually put together a Charles Dickens quiz, which terrifies me, considering we're with a Charles Dickens expert. But anyway, we'll move on to that a little bit later.
It might be where my credentials as a Charles Dickens expert fall apart.
Yes, this podcast will either do wonders or no help at all for your...
This could destroy my career.
So, Robin, Alex, how are you guys? Are you well?
I'm good, thank you, Martin. Yeah, I'm a little bit intimidated about this podcast today, because, like you say, yeah, I know nothing about Dickens except for Oliver Twist. That's a thing, okay. Isn't it? So that's basic. So yeah, I'm a bit scared about the quiz later.
So before we move on to our main topic, should we go through what we've learned this week? Richard, have you got anything that you've interesting morsel of knowledge that you've learned this week you can share with us?
What have I learned this week? Yes, I have learnt something fascinating this week, that the Proclaimers song, Letter from America, was in fact produced by Jerry Rafferty, that he was the producer for it.
Oh, okay. Nice. Interesting. Oh, that's interesting. Cool. Yeah. I don't know if you guys saw it, but there was a Proclaimers kind of musical drama that was on TV a little while ago. Did you end up watching that?
Oh, Sunshine on Leaf.
Was the one. Was the one. Yeah.
I didn't.
It was all right.
Was it good?
Yeah. Yeah. It was okay.
Stellar reviews from all.
Is it worth watching? If you're a big Proclaimers fan, it's worth watching. But yeah, no, it's fine. What about you, Alex? What have you learned this week?
So I learned just a little thing. Well, I'll ask you. What happened on November 22nd, 1963?
Oh, Kennedy assassination.
Yeah. I'm proud of both of you. Well done. Yes, John F. Kennedy was leaving the Hotel Texas in Fort Worth on the morning of his assassination. And guess who I found out? Who else happened to be there and appears in certain pictures as well? It's only Bill Paxton. Bill Paxton, the 8-year-old boy at the time, was there on the morning that Kennedy was shot.
Wow.
Bill Paxton from Titanic and Twister.
Twister, yeah.
Apollo 13.
And Terminator.
Yeah.
And can I just say it was also the day that the Taj Mahal restaurant opened in Mayfair.
There we go.
The Indian restaurant.
Do you know, it's a real shame that more people don't remember that day.
I only know it because they've got a little thing in their window that on the day they opened, their takings were zero. Because they got this big build-up, and then the Kennedy assassination happened.
Oh, no.
And they took nothing on their first night of opening.
Oh, dear.
Wow. It's amazing, isn't it, that it affected the world in such a way? Because you think that, a major event like this, that people would still be going out, but I don't know whether it was the time that it happened or the shock. But you think that they would still have some people going there.
Would a big world event like that make you more likely to want to go out and celebrate? Well, not celebrate, sorry. That's wrong. Have a good meal, I should say.
Celebrate life.
Well, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Thank you.
Can I just ask of the three of you, I mean, how many of you have seen JFK?
The movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. It's one of my favourite films all the time. Yeah.
Can you put your hand up if you saw it in the cinema?
Oh. No.
Afraid not.
Saw it on television?
I haven't seen it, sadly.
Did you see it on television?
First, I saw it on TV, and then now I have it on Blu-ray.
It's amazing, isn't it, how everyone can remember where they first saw JFK. I was hoping that one would go a bit better, actually.
I'm sorry, I derailed that with my enthusiasm.
Well, from Paxman and JFK, Robin, what have you got to bring to the table?
Well, I looked up the origins of the word ketchup, which I've often wondered about, because, you know, it's always Heinz tomato ketchup, which implies that there are other kinds of ketchup.
True.
It's like ketchup isn't just Heinz ketchup.
I've had other ketchups before. What exactly? Kind of privileged life are you living that you
just
assume
just tomato Heinz ketchup? That's all I've ever had. Yeah. Well, it's exactly what you think. Ketchup is just a word for a sauce, but I wondered, where does it come from? But it does, apparently, the current thinking is that it comes from a Chinese word, ketchup, in the Hokkien dialect. I'm probably saying that wrong. Anyone who knows how to say that properly, please correct me in the comments on YouTube or on Twitter. And it's the name of a sauce derived not from tomatoes, but from fermented fish. So I guess it's a bit like Worcestershire.
Oh,
Worcestershire sauce, yes. In England.
I wonder how that, like where, what's the journey that makes to then become like ketchup, as in tomato ketchup?
Well, there's the thing. It wasn't tomato ketchup until much later. That was just a variety. Apparently, all the early forms of ketchup in Britain, because it was the British who went over to Asia, came across ketchup, brought it back, continued to call it ketchup. And all their early attempts to recreate that sauce did not involve fish. They involved mushrooms or walnuts or stretched to oysters sometimes to try to get that flavor. And eventually, I guess, they had so many varieties of flavor to try to recreate this one specific fermented fish flavor. They had so many different varieties that they just ketchup became a catch-all name for sauce. And then eventually someone came up with tomato ketchup, and then I guess that kind of stuck as the default ketchup. In most people's minds, or at least in my mind. So that was my little trip
interesting
down history today.
Could I just ask what made you want to look it up?
I feel like there's a joke here.
No, it's not a joke.
just genuine interest.
You did say you often think about it. How often
think about it? Every time I have ketchup, and then once the meal is over, I forget. Yeah. So this time I remembered to look it up.
There we go. Well, this week, I learned something a little bit different. I want to ask you guys, have you heard of the name spelt T-O-N-I-B-L-E-R?
Is that a first name?
Yes.
Oh. Tonibler.
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 Tonibler. Okay. Well, this name is pretty common. Well, not that common, but it's fairly common in Kosovo.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Because Tonibler sounds a little bit like Tony Blair.
No.
and following NATO's military campaign during the Kosovan War in the late 90s, 1999, of course, Tony Blair carried out a lot of the airstrikes on Serbian forces, on Milosevic's forces, in the late 90s in the Kosovan War.
Because Tony Blair personally carried out those airstrikes. Exactly.
And so, as a result of that, there are plenty of children in Kosovo who have been named Tony Blair, following Britain's, and in particular Tony Blair's, help in this particular war. And it was in 2010 that there's this amazing picture of Tony Blair flanked by nine boys, all called Tony Blair.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Yeah. So go to Kosovo, you might meet Tony Blair.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. So let's move on to our main topic of the week. And Richard, I mean, you are the fountain of knowledge, the fount of knowledge. And I thought I'd just want to ask you a little bit about Dickens in relation to Christmas first, because, of course, Dickens is very much, you know, known for supposedly having a big influence on Christmas, and we are coming into the festive season. So it'd be great to hear what you think about this and really understand what kind of impact Dickens has had on our traditional Christmas.
Well, Dickens has had a massive impact on Christmas. It's often said he's the man who invented Christmas. Which, strictly speaking, isn't true, because I would say Jesus probably has a bigger claim than Charles Dickens. But what Dickens certainly did was give a blueprint by which Christmas could be celebrated, and that, of course, was Christmas Carol. And the amazing thing about A Christmas Carol is that he wrote it in just 6 weeks. He began it in October 1843, and he finished it on the 2nd of December 1843. And it was published at Christmas, and it was an instant hit. Thackeray, Dickens' great rival, reviewed it, and he called it a national benefit, and to every man and woman who reads it, a personal kindness. Did was it started people looking at how they should celebrate Christmas. So he didn't invent Christmas, but he brought all the traditions together for Christmas. The bandwagon for reinstating Christmas and getting it really going had been going since the 1820s. So Dickens simply jumped on a bandwagon. But what he did in that book was he pulled all these strands together: the games, the giving gifts, people the day off, employees the day off. So he really did give us that blueprint that, to an extent, to this day we still follow today. And of course, every Christmas, nowadays we do it on TV or on the internet or on tablets or iPhones. But in Dickens' day, once Christmas Carol came out, no Christmas would be complete without, in the evening, the whole family gathered around the fire because it was the warmest part. And then one member of the family would read A Christmas Carol to the entire household. And that could pass away 2 hours on Christmas evening, which had to be done. I always say to school children, I can guarantee your parents say it to you. My parents said it to me. And that is, in my day, we had to make our own entertainment. We didn't have the TV. We didn't have the internet. And I was saying, it's complete nonsense, because have you ever tried to entertain a family for 3 hours without a TV and an internet? It's impossible. And a lot of people, just reading Christmas Carol could while away a few hours on Christmas evening.
Okay, so you said that, that's really interesting. You said that, before this time, before Dickens' time, the kind of the trying to rebuild this idea of Christmas, and it sounds to me like a lot of Christmas traditions then were quite fragmented before Dickens's time. This kind of fragmentation of traditions, like either gathering around as a family, or I don't know what other traditions he in particular he brought about. Maybe you can go into that a little bit more. Before this, was it regionally based about how people celebrated Christmas?
What did it look like before this?
Yes,
before
I think Dickens? That's it. And kind of regionally as well. That's what I'm interested in, because it seems like he's brought these traditions together. And I'm just interested in exactly what it looked like before.
Well, it was more or less, it was celebrated. It was celebrated way, way back. But what happened to Christmas was quite simple. You had communities up until the 19th century. So late 18th, early 19th century, people tended to live off the land. This was an agricultural country. So people lived in villages. People lived on estates. What happened in the 19th century, early 19th century, was the Industrial Revolution and the Agricultural Revolution. And that threw people off the land, and it broke up communities, and they gravitated to the big cities, which is where the work was. And they went to work in the mills, the factories, all part of the Industrial Revolution. And employers came to see the employees as commodities, that basically they took them on, but they wanted to get as much as they could out of them. And so consequently, by about the 1830s, 1840s, certainly with the lower classes, lower working class up to middle class, Christmas wasn't being, they couldn't celebrate Christmas. They had to go to work on Christmas Day. And all sorts of things had happened to try and combat the problem. Because the big problem was they suddenly had all these people coming into the cities. Many of them were now destitute poor. And the authorities didn't know how to deal with them, so they tried to make it as unpleasant as possible to be poor, and this is one of the things Dickens is attacking in Christmas Carol. A lot of people don't realise A Christmas Carol is a very political novella. There's a lot of politics in A Christmas Carol that people miss because we don't take it against the background it was set against. And in fact, it was initially meant to be a political attack. It was meant to be Dickens' political pamphlet attacking something that had happened in Parliament.
Oh yes, what was that?
I'm glad you asked me that. it was a report, because one of the big things and one of the big scandals of it was that children were being sent to work in the factories. They were sent down the mines, they were sent into the mills, and they were working all the hours God sent. There's a very famous pamphlet called, or very famous illustration of a parliamentary report that was put out in the early 1840s, looking into the conditions of children working in the coal mines. And Dickens read that pamphlet. He said he read it with tears running down his cheeks because he was so angry at what he read. And he vowed he would strike a hammer blow for the poor man's child. And that hammer blow eventually became A Christmas Carol. And so that he's attacking all sorts of things in Christmas Carol. And we can come on to some of those a bit later if you like. But basically, that's what started the ball rolling for A Christmas Carol. He wanted to be a political pamphlet that was then attacking what was happening to all the children working in the mines and the factories.
So that report that he saw was the early 1840s, and he wrote A Christmas Carol in, was it 1843, did you say?
Christmas Carol, he wrote in 1843. The report came out in the early 1840s. Yep. And the 1840s were known as the Hungry 40s as well, because several corn harvests had failed. And so the spectre of starvation and famine, and also mass unemployment, began to sweep across the country.
Yeah. So did, just to pursue this political side of things for a bit more, do you think A Christmas Carol had the effect that Dickens was looking for? Because to
very
me,
much so.
Okay. So these days, Christmas Carol is just, you know, a jolly story about, well, ghosts and turkey and gift giving and not being a Scrooge. I can't think of a better word to describe what a miser is, other than to say,
isn't
Scrooge,
that good?
I suppose that's, yeah.
Coming up with that name, he came out with a word that, well, a name that became a word.
Yeah, that, incredible.
You really couldn't think of any other way to describe him. And he got that name, incidentally, from two words, screw and gouge. And he pushed screw and gouge together, and that's where Scrooge came from.
What's that word when names, I learned this in English years and years ago, but there's a word where, like, when you have a name for a character that basically describes them or encapsulates them as like a person and perfectly describes them. I can't remember. I can't remember what it's called. But
that was kind of one of Dickens'
his specialties.
Yeah, one of his distinctive features as a writer, isn't it, is the names of his characters and how they encapsulate their personalities.
Yeah,
very much. Yeah, you just have to hear the name and you can see the character.
Yeah, you know everything about him that you need to know just from his name alone.
Uncle Pumblechook. In Great Expectations, it says it all. And Mr. Micawber.
Yeah, that's a good one, isn't it? Yeah. So what were the particular issues that he was trying to highlight? Obviously, poverty and debt, I guess, are two big things.
Poverty. I mean, the interesting thing about Christmas Carol, you said, I mean, Dickens did it as a ghost story for Christmas for the very simple reason that one of the popular ways to while away Christmas evening was to tell ghost stories. People love ghost stories. The English have always loved, or the British have always loved telling ghost stories. Mm. And so people used to tell ghost stories. And ghost stories were popular at Christmas, which is why he wrote A Ghost Story for Christmas. And it's called A Ghost Story for Christmas. But in fact, if you actually think about Christmas Carol, it's not really a ghost story. It's a parable dressed up as a ghost story. And it's a parable about redemption. And that's what it's Scrooge's dark night of the soul, or dark journey through the soul. Mm. And he's going through. And it's wonderfully crafted. And given he wrote it in 6 weeks. I mean, but to craft that story in 6 weeks, and he always said, he said he walked about the streets of London night after night after all sober folk had gone to bed, with the Cratchits forever tugging his coat sleeves, urging him to hurry on home and finish their story. to write that story, and it's, I mean, the world over, people have heard the name Scrooge, and they've heard the name, A Christmas Carol. And also the fact that... If you think about it, how familiar with the story you are, but in fact, Ebenezer, as his first name, doesn't turn up very till way on into the book or into the novella. As far as Dickens was concerned, the name was going to be Scrooge. He got the name Scrooge. And in fact, throughout the entire Stave One, he's Scrooge. And the first time we get the fact his name's Ebenezer is when Marley's ghost turns up and calls him Ebenezer. But he's only called Ebenezer three times in the whole novella. Scenes. Yeah. There's that one with Marley, Fezziwig's party. He's called Ebenezer several times. And then the final time, here's a test. Where's the last mention of his first name being Ebenezer?
I'm guessing the graveyard.
It is. It's the gravestone. And in fact, the interesting thing about that is, even his nephew Fred, when the Ghost of Christmas Present takes him to Fred's place, Fred doesn't call him Uncle Ebenezer. He calls him Uncle Scrooge. Dickens, as far as Dickens is concerned. He's going to have the name Scrooge. Yeah. So.
That's interesting. Because,
Who calls their uncle by their surname?
Because I think in a lot of the readaptations, he is called Ebenezer, isn't he? He's Uncle Ebenezer. Yeah. Perhaps. But yeah, in the original. Yeah. So completely off topic here. What are your thoughts on the Muppets Christmas Carol?
Absolutely. It's my favourite version of all the film versions.
That's the correct answer.
apart from Michael Caine singing, it's brilliant.
I'm so pleased to hear that. that's made my day, definitely.
Michael Caine actually gets Scrooge. A lot of actors don't get Scrooge. Mm. Scrooge isn't naturally like that. You see it in The Ghost of Christmas Past. That's what Dickens does with the Ghost of Christmas Past sequence. He's telling us that Scrooge is the result of what's happened to him. Everything bad that's happened to Scrooge happened on Christmas Eve. That's when he was the solitary child abandoned in the classroom, whose father won't let him come home. So he's the child who can't go home. That's when his fiancée, Belle, his fiancée breaks up with him. That's when Marley died. Marley dies on Christmas. Marley died 7 years ago this very night. And so consequently, everything bad about happened to Scrooge has happened. And basically, he's thrown up this defense against the world. And that defense is being the miserly, miserable so-and-so who goes about life sort of telling all human people to keep away from him. And even blind man's dogs lead their owners down the alleyways so they won't have to encounter him. It's a fantastic setup for him. But there's a little clue in the first stave that there's something in there that Dickens... Because Dickens, again, there's a lot of subtlety in there. And it's that line that Dickens says that he was solitary as an oyster. And if you think about that line, solitary as an oyster's got the hard, ugly outer shell. But if you can crack that shell and get in, you find the pearl. And that's what the ghosts have got to do. They've got to open that shell and get to the pearl, which that's what they do.
Mm. Oh, this is what makes a great writer. Even if I've always thought it was a bit rushed, and now you've said it's 6 weeks to write. It makes sense.
Well, it is Dickens, rushed.
Overrated. Yeah.
But it is rushed. I mean, there's so much. I mean, if you think about it, there's a mega mistake in it as well, which is a contradiction. Is when Marley comes to see Scrooge, he tells him he's going to be haunted by three spirits. Mm. And he says he's going to be haunted over the next three nights. Expect the first on the morrow. But when he actually wakes up, it's all been done in one night. And that's why you have that line at the end. But they can do that. Of course they can. Dickens couldn't be bothered to go back and change it all.
Because was it serialized, was it?
No, this is the one that wasn't. This was a novella.
Yeah.
It came about because, two reasons. There was a political attacks in it, but Dickens was in debt as well. Dickens, he was almost bankrupt in 1843. He'd had a meteoric rise to fame and fortune, but then he'd gone to America to try and conquer America, and he'd gone with an agenda, and the agenda was to lecture Americans on copyright because they weren't adopting international copyright. And if there's one thing Dickens valued, it was money. So he started lecturing Americans about copyright. And when he'd gone to America, he'd borrowed from his publisher a few thousand pounds to actually tide him over. Mm. And that was secured on a travelogue of his experiences and a new novel. And the travelogue came out almost immediately when he came back, American Notes for General Circulation. And he laid into America and Americans, calls them uncouth people. He makes all sorts of attacks on them. And that made him quite unpopular. And then the novel came out, Martin Chuzzlewit, which again wasn't too flattering about America. And it flopped. It was his first major flop. It sold less than 20,000 copies a month. And he was almost on the verge of bankruptcy. And he thought he had to do something quickly. And that quick something was A Christmas Carol. And his publishers weren't interested. He went to his publishers, to Chapman Hall. He said, look, I want to get this out in time for Christmas. I've got to get it out in time for Christmas. I need the money. And they weren't interested. And so he self-published it. It's vanity publishing.
Yeah. Wow. That's got to be like one of the most successful self-publishing, self-published stories of all time, to shape the Christmas holidays. Yeah, the next.
I think that's incredible.
Couple of hundred years.
Yeah. It's almost like he spent a lot of money on production, and so he didn't make as much money as he thought he was going to make.
That's always the way, isn't it? was always the way. But that's one of those classic stories that you only see in Hollywood movies and you think, ah, this isn't true. The person's down on their luck. They make this one last desperate attempt to make everything work out, and it you know, works out fine for them. That's incredible. But just to go back to that question about Dickens, the claim that Dickens invented Christmas, focusing on A Christmas Carol, because that's what we've been talking about, traditions that appear in that book about Christmas, I mean, they could be as benign as it snows in the book, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Christmas is described as a snowy time of year, but I don't know. I haven't had many snowy Christmases. We all live. Most of us live around and in London, and London hasn't had snow for a very long time. No. And then, of course, there's things like... this is one that I particularly find particularly interesting, is turkey. Turkey is the traditional Christmas dinner that we have over here, at least... Maybe we got it. We probably must have got it from America, because that's where turkeys come from, and Hollywood's always got a turkey. But in Britain, everyone gets a turkey for Christmas. I think it's the top-selling fowl meat. Sorry, at Christmas time, by a long shot. It's like over twice as many turkeys are sold as everything else. But of course, the Cratchits get a goose.
Yep.
And one of my favourite stories is by a different author, but also of the 19th century, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I love Sherlock Holmes, and I love The Blue Carbuncle, which is his only Sherlock Holmes story that's set at Christmas. But that doesn't mention turkey at all. It's all about Christmas geese. And that was that was written and published in the 1890s, I think, which is 50 years after Charles Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol. So my question is, are there other examples of traditions in A Christmas Carol that we look at it today and think, oh yeah, that's what Christmas is? But really, when you think about it, and at the time, wasn't really a traditional Christmas at all until it was popularized by Dickens.
Yeah, there are all sorts of things. There's things in Christmas Carol that we take for granted that they weren't part of Christmas at the time. There's no Christmas tree in Christmas Carol. There's greenery, but there's no Christmas tree, because the Christmas tree, although it was around, we know Queen Charlotte, George III's wife, had got one at Kensington Palace in the late 18th century. So it was around, but it wasn't popular with the with households. They liked greenery. They liked having holly, mistletoe, ivy, mostly because it made the house smell fresher than it. Because if you imagine being cooped up in that house when it's getting cold with a coal fire going, so you'd have a lot of greenery around in the house, but not Christmas trees. Christmas trees didn't become popular until Queen Victoria married Prince Albert, who was German, and he brought a lot of German traditions into the British Christmas. And one of the things that he made popular was the Christmas tree at Windsor Castle. And in 1848, the Illustrated London News did a supplement, and the front cover showed the royal family gathered around the Christmas tree. And it was a bit like a celebrity endorsement today. Everyone thought, well, if they're doing it, we've got to do it. So that popularized the Christmas tree, and that started off. Presents. They don't give presents in Christmas Carol, because the giving mostly of presents was done after Christmas, done on Boxing Day.
Boxing. Yeah. It's all about the boxes that you give to people, isn't it?
Yeah. Or New Year's. It's quite popular in New Year a lot as well. Turkey is interesting, because the Cratchits do have a goose, but what Scrooge does is send them a turkey when he redeems. He sends the turkey to them, again, it's interesting in Christmas Carol. We don't know why Dickens did it, but if you actually look at the manuscript, look at the novella, and just see it on the page as opposed to on the film, he spells turkey with a capital T. The country. Yeah. We don't know why he did it.
Sends them the entirety of Turkey.
he sent Turkey to it. He said, just sent Turkey to it. But what that did was, when Scrooge sends the turkey to the Cratchits, the next Christmas people wanted turkey. So turkeys did become quite very popular. Goose became sort of the... Goose had been the popular one up until then. But then turkey became the sort of, if you could afford something luxury, like today when we have goose today, if you could afford the luxury of a goose, you know, goose is much more expensive today than turkey is. It's basically because not as many people like, because goose is, it's a lovely tasting bird, but you don't get a lot of meat on it.
I don't think I've ever had goose. Never seen it, ever.
I have a goose every Christmas. We have goose.
Do you get it from butchers or?
Yeah, I get it from I get it. I order it in November, and it gets couriered down on Christmas Eve. So,
oh wow!
Very nice.
Nice.
Very nice.
Yeah, my boys would not have anything else but goose now for Christmas lunch.
Oh really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, the turkey's always the most disappointing part. I don't know. Maybe this is controversial to say. No. It's always the most disappointing part of Christmas dinner. It's no one's favorite, is it?
When I wasn't vegetarian, turkey, no, least favorite meat. Just really bland tasting.
It's tricky to do it without drying it.
Yeah.
If you overcook it just a fraction, it dries. It's a difficult one to do, turkey. But if you actually put a bit of water in the carcass, whilst you're cooking it, it does keep the meat moist, and then it is nicer.
Do you have a cookery book as well?
I do. I always cook because my wife, when we first met, well, a long time ago now, she was a nurse, and so she used to work Christmas Day. So I always used to cook Christmas lunch or Christmas meal for us when she finished her shift.
Oh, yeah, nice.
So the tradition in our house has always been that I always cook the Christmas meal, I've learnt with time the ways to keep how to get the meat just right.
There we go. Lovely.
I think I got that off Jamie Oliver, actually. I think it was in the Jamie Oliver cookbook, that. But something about putting a bit of, it might have been Gordon Ramsay, it was one of the two, but you put water inside it and it makes sure that it stays moist.
That's a good
turkey. Steamed turkey.
That's it, yeah. not, you know, you don't fill it with water. And
a boiled turkey, that doesn't sound so good.
So this Christmas dinner, when I ruin it, and my wife says, "What have you done to the turkey?" I say, "Well, Richard said put water in it."
You've drowned it, Robin. You've drowned the turkey.
Yeah. Why is there water coming out of the oven? What's going on?
Yeah. Why is the kitchen flooded?
So Richard, Dickens. So are there, I mean, you said the Dickens, signs of Dickens are scattered all around London. Are there signs of a Christmas carol specifically in London?
It's interesting that, because there aren't, Dickens is non-specific about many of the locations. He doesn't name the locations. For example, we don't know where Scrooge's counting house was. We do know that Bob Cratchit, when he goes home on Christmas Eve, the first thing he does when he leaves the counting house is go down a slide on Cornhill. So we know the counting house was in the city of London. We know it must have been near Cornhill. And he does say it was beneath a church tower whose Gothic bell peeps slyly down on Scrooge from whose gruff old bell peeps slyly down on Scrooge from a Gothic window in the wall. So that limits the number of churches it could be. My own opinion is that it's St. Michael's on Cornhill. But then again, he doesn't tell us where Scrooge's house is as well. He just says it's tucked away down a court where it has no business to be. So we don't know. We don't know where the graveyard is, where Scrooge was buried. And so consequently, you can claim really anywhere in London without fear of contradiction. So yeah, that's the place. And people do it. That's the place Dickens had in mind. I always remember on my Christmas Carol tour, I always end in the churchyard that I think was the one that Dickens had Scrooge's gravestone in, St. Peter's on Cornhill. But I always remember, I think it was about 3 years ago, I got an email from someone saying, "Well, I went to Shrewsbury the other week, and we went to, I think it was St. Mary's Church, and they've got Ebenezer Scrooge's gravestone in the churchyard, and you said it was in St. Peter's." And I thought, yeah. So I did some in-depth research into it. I Googled it, and I found out that, in fact, yeah, there is. But what it was George C. Scott did a film version of Christmas Carol, which is a very good version, actually. And that was filmed in Shrewsbury. It wasn't filmed in London. It was filmed in Shrewsbury. And the vicar of the church persuaded them to leave when the film company actually had the gravestone specially done for the film. And the vicar persuaded them to leave the gravestone behind. So the gravestone's in the church. And it's even got its own TripAdvisor review page.
But it's just a prop from the movie, then.
It's a movie prop.
Is that in good taste? I'm not sure. Fake gravestones in the graveyard. Yeah, something slightly weird about that.
Well, if you think about the one last year that Guy Pearce did, I don't know if you saw the new Guy Pearce one. I really enjoyed that one, actually. I thought that they're actually looking into the backstory of Scrooge, that, you know, because obviously Dickens could not go into all the details that the Guy Pearce version, well, I've forgotten the chap who wrote, Stephen Knight, who wrote Peaky Blinders, wrote the screenplay. And obviously, Dickens would not have got it published if he'd gone into some of those details. But obviously, Scrooge's childhood would have been a bad childhood, being abandoned at school. So, you know, the hints are there in Dickens.
But A Christmas Carol obviously dominates the discussion when we're talking about Charles Dickens. But it wasn't the only thing he did about Christmas, was it? So no. It wasn't the only reason that people associate his version of Christmas so strongly with Christmas. Because he wrote, he wrote a series of books, didn't he?
Yeah, Christmas Carol was set the tone. I mean, Christmas Carol was a reworking in a way of an earlier story anyway that he put into Pickwick Papers.
And
it was a story called the Goblins Who Stole the Sexton. And it was a story about a guy called church sexton called Gabriel Grubb, who hated Christmas, hated everybody, and he gets taken down to the Goblin Kingdom, where the Goblin King takes him around the world and shows him people trying to enjoy Christmas. Now, there's one notable scene where he takes him to the bedside of a dying child, and says, "Look, you know, this family can enjoy Christmas. Why can't you?" And so Gabriel Grubb was the basis for Ebenezer Scrooge, or the blueprint for Ebenezer Scrooge.
Yeah.
And then he went on after Christmas Carol. The next year he wrote The Chimes, which actually outsold Christmas Carol at the time. It was a lot more popular than Christmas Carol was. But it's a bit too sentimental. I mean, nobody reads The Chimes anyway. It's too sentimental. And it's about New Year anyway. And then he started writing, every year he'd write a Christmas story. And in consequence, he became so associated with Christmas. There's a very famous, I can't remember who it was, but when Dickens died, it was an American writer who was in Covent Garden, and he found a young girl crying in Covent Garden. And he asked her, what was the matter? And she said, "I've just heard Charles Dickens is dead. Does that mean Christmas is gone?"
Oh, wow.
That's
amazing to be that connected and associated with Christmas,
even
during your life, because usually it's, well, as we found with Dickens, it's very much, you know, since he's died over the, you know, next 150 odd years roughly, that he's become so synonymous with Christmas. It's amazing during someone's life for them to be known as, you know, Mr. Christmas.
Yeah.
without being Santa Claus himself.
Yeah.
I just can't help but wonder, like, what would he have thought if someone went back in time and grabbed Charles Dickens and brought him forward 150 years. And he
just back to the future.
Just sat him down to watch
Muppets.
Bill and Ted, yeah.
Sat him down to watch Muppets Christmas Carol. What would he have thought of it?
He'd have loved it. He really would.
Who couldn't have loved it?
Yeah. He was very open to all sorts of things. People used to plagiarize him mercilessly. I mean, especially theaters. They used to put unauthorized film versions on of his books. And of course, they were appearing in installments. And they'd often bring the film version out when only for about 3 installments had appeared. So they'd have to sort of make the ending up. And Dickens used to go and watch them. And sometimes he said, "Look, you know, you're making such a hash of it. At least let me just write it for you." And
wow.
That's good. That's quite nice. So lesser authors would be much more protective and much more super happy, I suppose.
Well, he learned his lesson from Christmas Carol, because he did get plagiarized by a publisher in Christmas Carol, who put out a cheaper version, because Dickens insisted, I said it was self-published, and Dickens insisted on taking over all the production. And he spent lots of money. The original book, it was gold leaf on the cover, gold lettering on the cover, hand-colored illustrations throughout. It cost an absolute fortune. And a publisher put out a rival version that undercut it and just changed little bits of it. And Dickens took him to court. He said, and he won the case. He actually won the case. And he came out waving the judgment, saying, "I have slain the pirate." And the pirate's response was to declare himself bankrupt, and Dickens got stuck with all the legal costs. And after that, he never again, he just said, "No, I'm not." He just wouldn't go to court again. He just thought it's not worth it.
Yeah. That's interesting, when he went over to the US and spoke about copyright.
Yeah. He was fuming at America for not adopting copyright and saying, you know, because they were publishing his novels and not giving him any money for it. So he lectured America, and the consequence was, when he got to New York at the end of his trip, he was under almost daily attack from the American press. They're saying he's ungrateful. We welcomed him, and he does all this. But when he first went to America, the interesting thing about him was that he was a superstar, and people camped outside his hotel to get a look at him, and women broke into his hotel room and tried to get near him. And some people even chased him down the street and tried to pull out bits of hair to get souvenirs of him. He was a rock star. I mean, he really was. We think of him as this serious bearded Victorian, but he was a rock star, and he lived the rock star lifestyle as well.
Like Beatlemania, but
hugely popular.
Dickens mania.
And towards the end of his life, when he did the public reading tours, he used to sell out auditoriums, and ticket scalps were out there, sort of selling tickets for double the price, whatever. They were massive. He was massive. He was the Harry Styles, the Jamie Cullum of his age. You know, Mick Jagger. He was the rock star of his age.
Nothing changes, does it? That's surprising. Even the ticket outs. There's nothing.
Nothing.
The more things change, the more they say the same.
He was, in many ways, he was the world's first celebrity in the modern sense of the word celebrity. In that he understood the value of brand. That being a celebrity, you can become a brand. And so, brand Dickens was very important to him. And of course, Bran Dickens gave him a problem, because Bran Dickens was Christian house, hearth, and home. Mm. And when he ran off with an actress, when he was in his mid-40s, he ran off with a young actress. He tried to keep it secret because he thought that would destroy the brand. And so he made a complete hash of trying to keep it secret. So.
I mean, good thing he wasn't around when Twitter existed.
He'd have loved Twitter. He would have loved Twitter. He'd have been tweeting. He'd have been worse than Donald Trump.
But I feel like he would raise everyone's Twitter game as well, because I imagine Dickens wouldn't write a tweet in a bad way. He would, his language, his use of words would be so wonderful, everyone else would be forced to try to
he wouldn't spell the word pole wrong.
Well, I don't know, he spells turkey with a capital T.
Well, that's true.
Dickens' tweet gets flagged by Twitter, fact checking. Just like, this tweet may be misleading. The whole of turkey was not sent to the Cratchits.
Yeah, there's no way the Cratchits could have eaten all the whole of turkey.
So, Richard, you do Dickens tours around London, don't you? Can you tell us a little bit about that, and then maybe plug any links you'd like to?
To plug? I do a Dickens tour. Oh, I do lots of Dickens tours. I do one in Southwark, which is around Borough, and that's the area where his father. I mean, one thing about Dickens was the reason he was so good at writing about abandoned children was because when he was 11 years old, he'd been abandoned by his family. Effectively, his father had been arrested for debt and locked up in the Marshalsea debtor's prison. And they'd sent Dickens out to work, and he'd gone to work at a shoe polish warehouse or a blacking warehouse at Hungerford Market. And his job was to stick labels onto tins of boot polish. And it traumatized him. It really did. Because suddenly, this is a boy who, for at least 6 years, his father's convinced him he's going to become a gentleman. Mm. And then suddenly, and I can't resist this one, but his great expectations have come tumbling down around him. And he finds himself surrounded by the rough and the ready of his age. And interestingly, when he was working at the Blacking Warehouse, his best friend there was a boy called Bob Fagan. And later, he used the name Fagan. He used his name in there. If you knew Dickens, you'd turn up one of his novels sooner or later. Yeah. So
did
I started
his
to...
best friend was called Bob Fagan?
He was an older boy who looked out for him. Because Dickens had an attitude problem when he first went to... Because don't forget, he's like... His father was a civil servant, so his father was in the Navy pay office. And he wasn't wealthy. Well, he wasn't, because he spent all the money he had and what he didn't have as well. Yeah. But Dickens at least got a bit of an education. And suddenly all that's gone. And he's put into this factory of basically working with the... working what he called them the shabby genteel, the rough and ready of his age. And he had this... He was quite posh as far as they could see. They used to almost bully him, call him the young gentleman. And take the mickey out of him. And so he learned to sort of keep be guarded. And basically, he kept everything inside himself. Bob Fagan looked out for him, made sure that they didn't bully him too much. And when Dickens felt ill, Bob Fagan would escort him home or take it and make sure he got home all right. Yeah. Much to Dickens' chagrin, because he didn't want anyone to know that his father was in a prison and that he was living in lodgings on his own. So he used to take, when Bob Fagan walked him home, he'd take him to a different house and say, "That's my house." And because it looked quite a posh house, Bob Fagan wouldn't dare go anywhere near the door. And so Dickens would go to the step, bang on the door, and then he'd turn around and wave to Bob Fagan, who'd then turn and go off. And then when the door was answered, Dickens would say, "Is Bob Fagan in?" And they'd go, "No one here of that name." And then it was safe then for him to go home, to go back to where he actually lived. So he was ashamed. He was ashamed of all that, and it taught, and it left him with legacies. One legacy was that he dressed in rags, and that's why when he became famous, people who met him often commented on how flamboyantly he dressed. Again, he wasn't this stern figure. He wore colourful waistcoats, frock coats. He had his hair long. He wore his hair long, clean shaven. He didn't become bearded till 13 years before his death. So that was the legacy. Another legacy was that he became a control freak because he'd lost control at that period. That was never going to happen again. And so he had to control every situation he ever went into. And the final legacy was that the one character does better than any other writer is the abandoned child. Oliver Twist, David Copperfield. And if you think about his child characters, by the time they've hit 11 or 12, he's killed off one or both of their parents. They've all become orphans or something horrible's happened to them, and their childhood has ended. And that's because Dickens doesn't do teenagers. He never got teenager. His childhood ended abruptly. And so he makes his child characters relive it over and over again. And that's the autobiography of Dickens coming out in his novels.
Mm. Do you think for him it was some kind of therapy in a way? The fact that he was able to write about these things and almost tell his experiences without having to divulge that information, that personal information?
Definitely, no doubt about it. Because he did try to write his autobiography at the end of the 1840s. And he couldn't do it. The reason we know so much about this period is because he made autobiographical notes during this period, and he just couldn't do it. He couldn't make it public. He just felt it was too much. And his best friend was a man called John Forster, who effectively was his agent, his business advisor. And he went to Forster and said, "Look," he said, "I want to do the autobiography, but I can't do it." And Forster's suggestion: do a fictionalized account, and he did. And that fictionalized account was David Copperfield. And he always called David Copperfield his favorite child. And so when you read David Copperfield, it's Dickens' thinly disguised autobiography. And the clue's in the title. I don't know if you can spot the clue in the title. Should I put you to the test there? Should I do this?
You might have to put us out of our misery, Richard.
I was trying to think, was it like an anagram of his name? But it's not.
You're on the right lines. You're on the right lines.
DC?
DC?
CD. Exactly. DC.
Oh, yes.
CD.
Yeah.
Just like that's good. That's a mirror of his life. The initials are a mirror of his name or his initials. Yeah.
Thank goodness I've got a copy of David Copperfield reflected in the mirror over there. Yes, so sorry, just to cynically circle back to Martin's initial question. Where can we find all your stuff, your tours about Dickens and your writings?
You can get them on edgarguides.com. Edgarsguides.com. And I've also got my Dickens website, which is dickenslondontours.co.uk. And so dickenslondontours.co.uk, and it'll take you through. I've got all the stuff on Dickens on there. I've got all my tours are on them, from my Christmas Carol tour that I do dressed as a Victorian gentleman with a stovepipe top hat. So I got on that. And I've got a lot of the Dickens biography as well. I've also got I set myself the task in 2013 of reviewing every film version of Christmas Carol. I think I've got up to, I'm just in the mid-20s now, but I've done all, going right back to the very first film version in 1901, right through to the Muppets. I've watched some fantastic versions. I've watched some appalling versions as well. and it's interesting to notice how Scrooge changes with time. When Dickens created Scrooge, if you think of Michael Caine and think of Patrick Stewart and George C. Scott, even Guy Pearce, he's quite smart. He's got the top hat and the cape. That wasn't how Dickens would have envisaged Scrooge. Scrooge was a miser, and misers were people who didn't wash. They had one threadbare clothing because they wouldn't spend any money on clothing or well-being. So the one that, if you look at the early versions, that's how Scrooge is portrayed. If you look at Seymour Hicks's version from 1935, he played him on stage since the late 19th century and had become the quintessential Scrooge of his day. And he plays it. You see him in that. He's a miser. He's got the rags. He's in threadbare clothing. And it was only when corporate America began sponsoring versions in the 1950s that they didn't want that. The idea of him as they didn't like that idea. They started cleaning Scrooge up, and so Scrooge becomes this sort of smart person in the top hats. But I say this. I mean, those film versions from the 50s, the TV, they're all on YouTube now, and they're worth watching.
It's a shame. You think they could sell soap really easily with a dirty, filthy Scrooge character?
Well, yeah. You look at some of, I mean, you see a lot of the versions, and they are obviously acted by actors who've appeared in soap commercials, because they've just got all that. But no, Chrysler sponsored a version, which was done, and it's amazing to watch, because they cram as many mentions of Chrysler as they can into it.
I was going to say, I don't quite know where the connection is there, but I mean, if they're being shameless about it,
was it a Chrysler Carol or a Christmas Chrysler?
A Chrysler Carol, it was fun.
And it then, turns out that Chrysler was the true meaning of Christmas this whole time.
Yeah, at the end of it, Scrooge opens the window, looks out, you boy, you there in the Chrysler. Where's the nearest turkey?
And then a really weird version came out in 1963, which was it was called Carol for Another Christmas, and it was made by, of all people, that well-known film company, the United Nations. and it was done by the idea was, it was, I've just forgotten his name now. Is it Rod Serle who wrote The Twilight Zone?
Rod Sterling.
He wrote the script for it. And it was done by the United Nations because they wanted to take on the John Birch Society in America.
Oh. Who,
they were saying United Nations is all about one world order, one world domination. So they thought, well, the reason they're saying that is because they don't understand what we do. So they decided to form a film arm and then take all the airtime on all the American TVs Christmas Eve 1963, and they did this version called Carol for Another Christmas. Okay. And it's Peter Sellers is in it, and the chap who plays it's not Ebenezer Scrooge in this, it's Daniel Grudge, and it's very Cold War. It becomes pure propaganda for the United Nations. But it's a fantastic film version, and it's really creepy at first, because Rod Stoll, who does it, he starts off with a, and I won't spoil the beginning in case you watch it, but it's a really good beginning, and but then it becomes pure propaganda. It's like you get all this stuff about, you know, well, and all these statistics come up about the atomic bomb, you know. And of course, this is the time when they thought we just had
Merry
the Cuban
Christmas.
Missile crisis. So it doesn't have to put a dampener on Christmas. Yeah. But and the chap who plays Daniel Grudge was, what was his name? Sterling Hayden, who was in Doctor Strangelove.
Oh, yeah. With Peter Sellers, yeah.
Yeah, he plays Daniel Grudge. And
bodily
Peter Sellers in between.
Scattering, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the year Doctor Strangelove had come out. Peter Sellers in between had managed to have a heart attack. So this was his first one coming back after his heart attack. And he plays the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, which is fantastic. When you bear in mind, this is 1963, and he lives in the Imperial Me generation, where the whole world is obsessed by me. And if you think it's the social media generation that's me forecast that. So it's a fantastic, but it's called Carol for Another Christmas. And
that's intriguing. I mean,
that's amazing.
If you're going to sponsor it, you at least want to get your brand message in there, don't you? A bit of propaganda.
Well, you get
it. It's really interesting that so many people have tried to sponsor a Christmas Carol. If you had to have a list of stories you thought that people maybe wouldn't sponsor, it might be something that's supposedly has such a sentiment, well, actually, you know, sentimentality is quite a big, quite easy to tie a brand to, but yeah, it just seems odd to me so many people have done this.
Well, what's interesting about it is that because corporate America got involved, the message changes. If you think about when Scrooge reforms in all the modern versions, he reforms, he goes out giving away money, and that's not in A Christmas Carol. Money's hardly mentioned at all. The whole point about Christmas Carol is money's what's made Scrooge so miserable. And when Scrooge reforms, he doesn't say, I'm going to give money to everybody. He says, I shall keep Christmas in my heart every day of the year. So the message is, it's about Christmas and peace and love, man. that's the message of it. But of course, when it changes, he goes handing out money. I mean, and you see that a lot in, for example, the Ross Kemp version that Ross Kemp did in 2000. Which was, when he was Eddie Scrooge.
Eddie Scrooge.
Surely that has to be one of the worst versions out there.
I thought it was fine. You'd be surprised how good it is.
Which versions are bad then, Richard?
Well, the bad version, there's one called, which again, it's in almost its entirety on YouTube, is Ebenezer. And it was, okay. And it stars Jack Palance. And he plays Scrooge as a Western gunslinger.
Nice.
And it's,
oh my gosh.
It's one of those films that's so bad it's brilliant. It's so on PC. And I tell you who is in it as well, is Ricky Schroeder's in it. But that's when he wanted to be taken seriously, so he'd become Rick Schroeder. and it's so fantastic. And Tiny Tim it's a brilliant Tiny Tim, because the actor who plays him looks so ill you don't think he's going to survive the film. but it's just one of those films, just when you think it can't get any worse, it gets worse.
Ebenezer, right, I'm gonna have to look that one
I'm
up.
Making
Ebenezer,
a note of all these recommendations.
This is fantastic. Yeah, I was worried for a moment, Richard, that you've been suffering some kind of Stockholm syndrome watching all these Christmas carols back to back, and by the end of it you're just like, I just love this thing, I don't care bad it is.
As you watch them, you just want bad versions, because you know, when it's good it's the same story, so you just know the story.
True.
So you're not really watching, you know, I mean, it's like the Titanic, you know, you know it's not going to end well. You know, yeah. No happy ending in Titanic. But we strayed sort of off the novel there, didn't we? In the novella, we strayed a bit away from him there.
That's right. You've expanded our horizons. This is wonderful.
Yeah, because you did ask me about the political points in it, didn't you? And
we did. Yeah, before we move on, I guess. To the quiz. I know. What were the political points that he was trying to...
The biggest political point was an attack on a clergyman turned economist called Thomas Robert Malthus, who'd come up with an essay called The Principles of Population in 1798. And he argued that if a man can't afford to have a family, then he doesn't deserve to have a family. He mustn't have a family. And the authorities have based the workhouse on Malthus's preachings. And so Malthus had died in 1836, Malthus died. But his preachings, Malthusian economics, were still an important part of this new industrial revolution. And they came up with the workhouses that made it really unpleasant for poor people to go into the workhouses. They split families up. And so Dickens detested everything Malthus stood for. And so he attacks him in Christmas Carol lots of times. The Cratchits, for example, are just the family that Malthus says shouldn't have the right to live. They shouldn't have a family. And yet they're a happy family. They're a hardworking family. They're just poor. And that's why the Ghost of Christmas Present says to Scrooge, he said, you know, man, if man thou be, what right have you to say who the surplus population is and where it be? In the eyes of heaven, this man's family is more important than you, with all your effectively all your wealth. But very early on, there's the attack, which is a brilliant attack. And a lot of people don't get the fact there is attacking Malthus in it, is when the two charity collectors turn up and they ask him for money. And he says, well, are there no workhouses? Are there no prisons? They said, oh, yes, the prison's workhouses. And he said, and then they go on and said, well, he said, what should we put you down for to give to the poor? He says, nothing. And the man says, you wish to be anonymous? He said, I wish to be left alone. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. And then the man, he says, you know, I pay for the workhouses and my taxes. I pay for the poor law. Those who cannot survive should go there. And that's when the man says, well, many cannot go there and many would rather die first. And then comes the attack on Malthus. Well, if they would rather die, then better then let them and decrease the surplus population. And that's exactly what Malthus's essay was about. So Malthus gets attacked constantly. His other argument was that food is finite. So if we allow people to breed and don't keep a check on population, then the food's going to run out. And Dickens' argument was, which sadly, it's an argument we're still having today. There's plenty of food. We just don't manage the distribution. We waste so much of it. That's why when the Ghost of Christmas Present takes Scrooge to the Cratchit house, Dickens doesn't, unusually for him, describe the streets. He doesn't describe the geography of the area. He describes the food in the shop windows. And he's saying all this food. If you read the passage, there's nuts from Brazil, oranges from Spain, and he's describing all the food that's going to go to waste because we're not managing it so well. And sadly, we're arguing the same today. Goodness knows how many years after.
Very true. Very true.
Very true.
Yeah. Yeah. Very.
Hmm.
Sorry,
I'm fancy an orange now.
You think it's just a wholesome Christmas story?
So sorry to have put a dampener on things. God bless us, everyone. Merry Christmas.
Well, as it's the Christmas special, what Christmas traditions do you all have? Do you have anything unique Ooh. To your households? Or what's your routine? Do you get up? Do you open presents first? When do you have your lunch?
Presents first, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, for us, here in the UK, there's two things, aren't there? Traditionally, there's opening your presents in the morning or opening them in the afternoon after the Queen's speech. Because I imagine that our American listeners and other people around the world, that tradition is fairly obsolete.
I did not know the Queen's speech was a thing that happened on Christmas Day until I was 22 years old.
What?
I just...
What?
Well... I'm
not, you don't watch the listen to the Queen's speech, Robert. How fit. Could you?
Do you have a yeah? Do you not have a television or radio?
I did. I had both of those things. I think my family was just a bit too heathen, and maybe that's why I'm not a royalist. I don't know. Maybe religiously grown up watching the Queen's speech every Christmas.
Can I just back you up there? I never watched the Queen's speech.
Neither do I, but I knew it existed.
Yeah. No, I don't either. I don't think anyone on this podcast watches the Queen's speech.
No, I can't understand the fuss over it. Yeah, it's not even live. I mean, she's recorded in the middle of summer.
Exactly.
It's worse than Guy Pearce.
It's all scripted. She doesn't improvise a thing. Where's the improv?
Where are the jokes?
Where's the corgis? You never see the corgis, do you?
Oh dear. No, but there is that debate though. Where does everyone stand on the whole opening your presents on Christmas Eve versus Christmas Day?
Just wait.
Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know. I think it's a growing thing in the UK, but certainly it's a German tradition. I think I feel like people are arguing about it all the time that I know. Opening your presents on Christmas Eve so you can concentrate on the real meaning of Christmas on Christmas Day itself.
Okay.
I think is the thinking. But it probably comes from the tradition of stockings you do on Christmas Eve, but you wouldn't have proper presents, you know. If you have stockings, you're probably too poor to have presents to open on Christmas Day.
Darn them. I'm darning my socks.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I guess we kind of do that in the sense that Boxing Day is more that just like relaxed family day than Christmas Day. Mm. I don't know. I always kind of actually prefer Boxing Day. Like Christmas Day seems a bit too hectic.
Mad. That is madness.
No, it's not, because like you get all the presents, on Christmas Day, but you can't actually like enjoy them until at least Boxing Day.
I understand that you speaking now, but as a child, I remember being Christmas night. Lying in bed and just being devastated, being like, it's over for another year. The dream's dead. The dream's dead for another year.
Do you know, I can so relate to that. I can remember that, thinking, it's a year away.
It's done. There's no time now that's further away from the joy of Christmas.
And I only ever got an orange for Christmas.
Oh.
A year before I can have another orange. I do have one tradition on Christmas morning, which I've done every Christmas, and they're going to hate me. They're going to hate me for revealing this, but ever since my lads were little, they were brilliant. I had the two best kids at Christmas. They never got up early.
they
never woke up. We used to have to wake them up. So every Christmas, we gave them sleeping tablets the night before. But we spiked their milk. But every Christmas morning, I videoed them coming down the stairs every Christmas and going to their stockings by the fireplace and opening their Christmas presents. And they're 20, 21 and 23 now. Mm. And I've got all those Christmas mornings going right back to when they were 1 and 2 years old, of them coming Amazing. Down the stairs in the morning. And I made them do it last year.
Nice. Good.
And they had hangovers and they go, oh.
You're still spiking their drinks. Is that
still spiking the drinks, yeah.
Well, on that note, who wants to do a quiz?
Yes, absolutely.
Sounds good.
So, welcome to this week's quiz. And appropriately enough, this week's quiz is all Dickens themed. So this gives Richard perhaps a little bit of an advantage, you might say. But to their advantage, Richard actually answered a few of these questions in the previous, well, hour of the podcast. So if they're paying proper attention, Martin and Alex have equal chance of getting these quiz, well, some of these quiz questions correct. But of course, Richard, no pressure. If you get this wrong,
yeah. I know.
Yeah. So, of course, any decent.
Well, if I do, I can just say that I was doing it just to, you know, not
to humour,
not yeah. appear.
Just to give us a.
I was being modest. I was being modest.
Yeah, just to massage our egos a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, every good quiz needs a good buzzer. So, gentlemen, show me your buzzers, Alex.
Well, I've gone for my classic
French champagne, has always been celebrated for its excellence. There is a California champagne by Paul Masson.
Classic John Corson. He served you well.
He has. I'm hoping he'll serve me well continuing into season 3.
He was definitely served well in that advert, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Constant drinks.
Martin, what's your buzzer?
I've gone for one of my classics too. Delia, also drunk. Yeah, Delia shouting at Norwich supporters.
Drunk Delia Smith. So Martin and Alex have gone for drunken celebrities. Richard, what's your buzzer?
I'm going for the high tech again. I'm going bah humbug.
Nice. Very good.
That's brilliant. Okay then, 10 questions as always, and a bonus question if there's a tie. I don't know how we can have a 3-way tie, but I suppose it's possible. Question number one. Charles Dickens' middle initials were J and H. What did J stand for?
Bah humbug.
Yes, Richard.
John.
John, correct.
John. Should have guessed John.
And there's a reason I chose J instead of the H. And why is that, Richard? What's his H? What does H stand for?
Oh, Huffham. Huffham.
Huffham, yeah.
Huffham.
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 H-U-F-F-A-M.
That's it.
Yeah. Oh, unusual.
Yeah. It was his godfather's name, Christopher Huffham.
There you go.
There we go.
Brilliant. Well, I didn't think Alex and Martin would be able to guess that. I certainly would be able to guess that.
Not. Unlikely.
So, 1-0 to Richard, going to question two. Dickens' second novel, The Parish Boy's Progress, is better known as...
Ah, humbug.
Yes, Richard.
Oliver Twist.
Yes, correct.
Okay. I think Richard's got a very advantageous buzzer.
Was there any point in us in the buzzers?
Yes, there was. I'm looking forward to hearing them.
Okay.
2-0 to Richard.
Okay.
Question number three.
We've got to buzz in quick, Alex.
This is not a closest wins, but the answer is numerical.
Okay.
How many books are there in Charles Dickens's Christmas
French
series?
French champagne.
Okay, Alex. Confidently buzzed in there.
I believe in his Christmas series there were five. Five.
There were five.
Yes! Yes!
There were five books. Yes.
That's why I confidently buzzed in, obviously.
Yeah. I'm actually impressed. Well remembered. 2-1-0. Richard, Alex, Martin, going into question four. What was Charles Dickens's pseudonym or pen name when he wrote early works?
Has always been celebrated for its excellence.
Yes, Alex.
I think this was a different thing than this. David Copperfield.
no. Good.
No.
Good
guess based on that. But
see what you're thinking.
Never mind.
Bah, humbug.
No. Yes, Richard.
Boz.
It was Boz. It was. Well done. Were you waiting? Were you giving them a chance to buzz? Is that what was going on there?
No, my buzzer failed.
Oh, yeah. Technical problem. Yeah, yeah.
the fuse blew. I had to rest.
All right, then. 3-1-0, going into question 5. At a live performance, I guess, or reading, of David Copperfield, which American author described Charles Dickens as a bad reader?
Good question. Which American author? Mm.
And this, Charles Dickens did the reading, so it's an author of that era.
Mm-hmm.
You will have heard of him.
From that time. Unsuccessfully.
Humbug.
Yes, Richard.
shall I?
Yes, please.
Mark Twain.
It was Mark Twain. Did you know that, or was that a guess?
No, I did know that, yeah.
You didn't know that.
Oh no, this is important. We're getting the sympathy. I'll give him a chance. This is embarrassing.
It's rightfully embarrassing.
Robin, can you chuck in like a Fast and Furious question? Yeah. Just
which Fast and Furious movie?
Dickens' 18th novel. Fast and Furious.
40 miles an hour on a horse and cart. Okay, question number 6 and 4-1 to Richard. In A Tale of Two Cities, what are the two cities?
Ooh.
Well, this is very embarrassing.
This is quite embarrassing.
Never.
I haven't read it, unfortunately.
No. Oh. I haven't read this.
Je ne sais pas. Je ne sais pas.
Okay. I do not know.
Pourquoi?
I'm thinking it's a French city.
Voulez-vous?
Tu peux faire this game.
Course, proof. Call blimey. I can't.
French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence.
Yes, Alex.
Is it London and Paris?
It is London and Paris.
Thank you, Richard. Incredible. For giving me that.
There you go.
I just couldn't remember.
I knew it was in France and England, but I just couldn't quite get the exact location.
Do you have one of those like memory palaces, Richard? You know, where all your knowledge is locked in rooms, and you have to remember the pathway through with key words. And that's what you're doing, right? You're finding those key words to unlock the doors in your memory palace. Yeah.
Well, I've got Google down here.
Yeah. I mean, there's that. Hey, that's
a good
loud.
Idea, actually.
Oi. So that's 4-2, going to question 7. This was, I'll give you a clue here, this was answered by Richard during the podcast. So,
can I have the points then? We just don't need to do it.
No, because your recall.
I should get extra points because I preempted it.
This is a test of your recall, Richard. So, which of his novels did Dickens describe as his favourite child?
I've got it. My buzzer's not working.
Martin straight in there with a...
David Copperfield.
It was David Copperfield. Yay.
I was listening.
Richard, you look like you had a technical fault there. You,
I did. Yeah, I was. The fuse blew again.
What a shame. Great. So that's 4-2-1. Yeah. Yay. Going to question 8. Right.
It was 2 already. I can still bring it back.
I thought it was 2 already. I thought it was that 3 now.
Oh, so it's 2 for me, but Martin's yeah, no, just
I was on a big fat 0 before then.
Ah, sorry.
But it's okay. I can still bring it back, which I clearly will.
I suppose there's time. There are 3 questions to go. There's possibility.
Don't I suppose, you know, it could easily happen.
It could definitely will happen. Yeah. Okay, question number 8. Which 19th century world leader said Dickens had a large, loving mind and the strongest sympathy with the poorer classes?
World leader.
19th century world leader.
19th century world leader.
But not necessarily a politician, of course.
Oh. Oh, no, not a politician. Oh, not a politician. Okay.
We'll go for it.
Bar humbug.
Nah, if it's not.
Was that Buzz Martin before
Richard? No. Okay. I think you buzzed.
Okay, Richard, yep.
Queen Victoria.
It was Queen Victoria.
Okay.
It was indeed, yes. Sorry if the wording was ambiguous in the question. Again, did you know that, Richard, or was that a guess?
That was a guess. That was a guess. I mean, I could claim that
You could say you knew it, yeah. I'm just curious because you know everything else. I'm just like, oh, is it possible? That's 5-2-1. Going into question 9. There's still time. Martin, you can get this.
You get second place, Martin.
This is true.
That's actually true. Okay, definitely fingers on buzzers here.
There we go.
How many spirits visited Ebenezer Scrooge?
Has always been celebrated for its excellence.
Yes, Alex.
3.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
3. Okay, good.
Phew.
See, humbug.
What? Have I got it wrong? What was that? What was that buzzer, Richard? What's going on?
It was a buzzer. Well, technically, Marley was a spirit.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
That's and technically, when Marley's ghost leaves and backs out of the window and the window lifts up, Scrooge goes to the window and there's thousands of spirits in the air outside.
Yes. See, I thought of that scene and I thought that I'm not even guess how many spirits there are there. But I admit I hadn't thought of Marley and the three spirits.
So you're saying I don't get the point?
It's four.
Okay, I'm going to let everyone buzz again, and the first person to buzz and answers can claim this point.
There's a California.
Having
but you got it wrong, though. You've already had your guess.
Having reflected on this wrong, I'd actually like to say 4.
The answer is 4.
Thank you.
That gives you 3 points, Alex. So 5-3-1.
Oh, humbug.
Oh, no. Oh, come on. Hey, what is it now?
Well, technically, Marley doesn't visit him because it's Marley's house.
Can you visit your own?
So technically, I was right the first time and this whole thing should just be
edited. Either way, you've got the points.
Okay.
True.
There we go. I mean, who are we kidding? This is we're being trounced here.
Right. So, question number 10. Final question, and this is definitely fingers on buzzers because it's a true or false. So, there's a possibility.
I love these ones.
Yeah. True or false? Dickens's unfinished novel is called The Mystery of Edwin Drood.
Bah, humbug.
I think that was Richard.
I think it was.
I don't know. I heard that buzzer go off just as I was saying it. So
I don't know it though.
Is it you?
I think Alex and I both heard you first, Richard. So
yeah. Are you sure?
Yeah.
Sorry, Martin.
What was the question again?
Okay, I've only got one.
What was the question again? I'm just being nice.
The question is true or false.
It's true. Yes, it is true.
Yeah, of course it is.
Well then, I mean, it's the appropriate name really for an unfinished novel because you know. We'll never know.
A complete mystery. Dickens dropped dead before he finished it.
There we go.
Yeah. Were any clue as to the answer of the novel, the resolution, I should say?
Well, we do in a way because in the 1920s, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle held a séance in Portsmouth, and he got a medium to get in touch with Dickens' spirit, and Dickens finished it from beyond the grave. So it was actually finished posthumously. Through automatic writing by a medium from beyond the grave. And
that's cool.
Well, it's not, because it demonstrates one thing. Writing talent does not transcend the grave.
One interesting thing that we didn't actually mention, but the fact that Charles Dickens and Arthur Conan Doyle were both in the ghost club and conducted like paranormal investigations, didn't they? Maybe that's a story for another time.
That's true, yeah. We're going to talk about another podcast. Please let us know, listening to us on whatever platform you listen to or watching us on YouTube. Let us know via Twitter or in the comments below whether you'd like us to talk about that story of Dickens and Doyle in the Ghost Club. But that doesn't take away from the victory, the twist shock victory that Richard has secured in this Dickens-themed quiz.
And very good, Richard. Never get anywhere. Yeah.
Would you like a bonus question?
Oh,
yeah. Well, if there is one.
Is it Dickens-themed?
Sorry. Yeah, it is. But it is a closest wins. So,
oh, okay.
So
okay.
There's a chance, okay. Again. Closest wins. How many Christmas short stories did Dickens write for the Household Worlds and All the Year Round magazines? How many Christmas short stories did he write for those two magazines?
French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence.
I think he was quite prolific with these stories, and I think he wrote at least 25.
Okay, 25 is your guess. Martin, do you have a guess?
It's one of those where I'm like, could Richard perhaps go first? the rough ballpark. Let's. I reckon, yeah, prolific. But then Christmas isn't, the season's not that long, is it? He's probably doing it for about 10 years, maybe a couple of year. I'm going to go for slightly less. I'm going to go for 17.
Okay. Richard, what's your guess?
I'm going to go for 15.
Oh, okay. Well, the answer I have written down, and I stress that because I'm scared that Richard has a different answer to the one that I've got, is 18.
Oh, wow.
So Martin gets the point, because he wrote, but he only wrote one Christmas story, an annual Christmas story for those magazines, and those magazines ran for 18 years.
There we go.
One after the other. They didn't run concurrently. Is that right, Richard?
Don't know.
Paranoid.
That was pure guess on my part. So.
Oh, great. Well, it was close. It was very close. But Martin was just closer. So, yeah. Yep. Well done. And any...
Well done, Martin.
Do I win the quiz?
You do win the quiz. Richard, go home in shame. Yeah, you have lost the quiz.
you should get extra bonus points for that.
Well, then. Well, thank you, Richard. And well done for winning the quiz. Again, great pleasure for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Fantastic. Really enjoyed
wonderful.
It.
Yeah. And we're going to be sure to check out one of your Christmas tours, or I will anyway, your Dickens Christmas tours and your Edgar's Guides.
Edgar's Guides. And I'm putting the dates up tomorrow, but I'll be doing a virtual Christmas carol tour over Christmas as well.
Oh, amazing.
I'll be wearing my Scrooge outfit on camera.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. Well, by the time this podcast is live, those dates will definitely be up. We're recording this at the very beginning of December. / the end of November.
And, we'll link to those in the description for sure.
Yeah,
so you have
absolutely.
So you can click one over.
You should have a prediction if it's going to. Is it going to snow at Christmas? On Christmas Day.
No. it's unlikely. I don't want to get my hopes up. Yeah.
I don't know. I've got a fact about this actually, which I found out the other day, but it wasn't my fact of the week. In the UK, the official definition of a white Christmas is if at any one of the several hundred Met Office weather stations around the country, a snowflake is observed falling.
Ah, it'd be interesting to know then how many white Christmases we've had.
Apparently quite a lot.
Our standards have fallen
standards
heavily,
have
haven't they?
Really dropped.
We'll just take one snowflake this year. Yeah. That's fine. That's all we want.
And is that snowflake in the traditional meaning of the word, not the modern...
No, oh,
right. Oh, white Christmas every year. Yeah.
So, where did that person come from? Just a plane flying overhead. No. Well, again, thank you so much
for a
fantastic podcast. And maybe it's a bit early, but a Merry Christmas.
And God bless us, everyone.
Yay.
Very good.
Right. See you all next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.